Yes, it can be. Like when we, for example, when we have aversion in the mind, something's arising, we have aversion in the mind, and our attitude of mind is, I want to get rid of this aversion. You can see that there's a trying an aversion in the attitude of mind to get rid of aversion or anything else. So it can be that way, but when it's that obvious, then we have sleepiness being known, and you have dullness through which you're looking at this sleepiness. So then it's like a filter over the mind. So it's like the knowing mind has the filter of aversion while it looks at aversion, or it has the filter of sleepiness while it's looking at sleepiness, or something like that. But that's one way of understanding an attitude of mind. But what I heard you say was, the sleepiness is in the observing, not as a reaction to the sleepiness. Meaning, if pain arises and we have aversion to it, and we're seeing the aversion to this pain, then the aversion is a reaction to, or the quality of the relationship to, the object, right? Because of the unpleasantness of the object, there's aversion through which we're looking to see that. But the attitude of mind is not one of these filters between the knowing and the object. The attitude of mind is not this. The attitude of mind is in the actual activity of the knowing, expecting, trying, having some agenda in the mind that's knowing. So it's a little different, whether you're looking through a lens of aversion, desire, delusion at some object, or whether the attitude of mind in the observing, which is also some quality, may be a quality of attachment, aversion, or delusion, or it may be a wholesome attitude of mind. Skillful. Yeah. If it's on a screen
Yeah,
or after the thought.
right, like an act, so a thought arises, you observe the thought, and then, so it's sort of like an afterthought, as opposed to something that has a disconnect, if that makes sense.
Let's just say that of all objects to be known, thoughts are very elusive, very thin, very intangible compared to sensations or even emotions. So thoughts are almost like they happen, then we know them. But with practice, you can learn to observe the mind thinking and not and know what you're thinking, but not be entangled in it with practice. But a lot of times what I hear you saying is that a thought goes by, and then after the thought, you recognize, I just had a thought, or I was thinking. Or you'd been thinking for a while, when it stops, then you recognize that thinking had been happening. That's how we initially begin to notice thoughts. With more experience, you'll see thoughts more simultaneously as they occur. You'll recognize them. Can do. The knowing of awareness and the attitude of mind, are they two different things? Yes and no. Yes, they're two different things in that the nature of the mind is to know. That's its nature. The nature of desire, for example, is to cause you to see only the pleasant aspect of what you're looking at. That's the nature of desire. The nature of aversion is cause you to only see the unpleasant aspect of what it is you're looking at. The nature of the mind is to know. To know. But the knowing may be influenced by or may be accompanied by expectation. Right? So then we have an attitude of expectation, or we have an attitude of anticipation, We have an attitude of striving, wanting a kind of experience. So then the attitude is different than the knowing quality of the mind. But the attitude of mind occurs simultaneously or within the knowing mind. The best you could do is notice the attitude of mind. Okay, if there's an attitude of mind to know, that's good. I remember when I first started practicing this kind of recognition of awareness, or recognition of the mind, the knowing mind, I had, 30 years of practice in another tradition, which is object-oriented practice. So my mind, my habit of mind was to identify everything as objects. Objects being known, what was I aware of? So I was always looking for the attitude of mind out here. And the attitude of the mind is back here in the awareness. So it was a little dissonant. It just didn't work to look for the attitude of mind like I would look for an object, sensation in the body, thought in the mind, emotion in the heart. They're different. The mind, the knowing mind, is different than that kind of object. Yeah, it's a different kind of object. Yes?
Yes, Steve, I'm wondering just on that, as a follow-up to that, if sometimes you're using the word mind with a small m and sometimes with like a big m, the reason I ask is I started with Vipassana, but I've been around the block a few times with a few different teachers, and I find what you're saying is perfectly in alignment with my own observations and teachings that I've heard, but only in relation to the fact that I feel lucky on those days when I can witness my mind thinking. But in that sense, what I usually say is going on is I'm in the awareness, as the awareness, looking at the mind. What I think you're saying is you're in the knowing mind, and I can reconcile those if I think of what you're saying as being like the knowing mind being like a capital M, like a big mind or what have you, and looking at a small one.
Yes and no. Dharma's like that, kind of paradoxical. When you kind of attributed something to me that I want to disavow, I don't see myself in awareness in the sense that, I'm being aware. Initially, there can be some recognition, if we're doing something kind of, then it seems like I'm aware. But with practice, you begin to recognize that awareness happens without you. Awareness happens without you. You don't make it happen. But having heard about awareness, having some way of looking at it or for it, it can be recognized. It can be recognized by what? Not me. I don't recognize awareness. Wisdom recognizes awareness. Sometimes they say being mindful of mindfulness, being aware of awareness, but really that's kind of, I never use that language because it kind of drives people crazy. Being aware of awareness, being mindful of mindfulness, instead what I just said was when you've heard about awareness, and awareness of objects, when you've heard about awareness, so that you're not just object-oriented, but you're now, there's something that's there's awareness of the object, and you've heard about it, and then you try, even though we don't know where to look or what to look for, because it's only a word, it's only an idea, awareness, but we begin to recognize it. Or I should say, awareness has begun to be recognized passively. Not because if we know how to do it, we just do it. But we can't do it. But sometimes having heard about it, now it can be recognized. What is it that recognizes awareness?
That's my question.
Huh?
That's the heart of my question.
Yeah. Wisdom. Wisdom recognizes awareness. Delusion doesn't recognize awareness. But in that case, then when I talk about object being known and the awareness and checking your attitude of mind, what is it that recognizes the attitude of mind? Also, wisdom. And if there's no recognition of the attitude of mind, or there's no recognition of the mind, you may still have wisdom of the nature of the object. You can watch the object. You can see the nature of the object. Desire is to cause the mind to see only the pleasant aspect of what it's looking at. So you can know the nature of the object, the unique, specific nature of the object. You can also know that the object has the characteristics of dukkha, anicca, and anatta. It's impermanent, it's conditioned, it's unsatisfactory. So you can know, you can develop wisdom on the object. What I'm pointing to is the wisdom, the recognition of the nature of mind and awareness. Okay? I've never practiced Advaita. I've heard about it. I've heard some of the language they use. Similar.
Yes.
Not same.
Exactly.
Yeah. Partly because, you know, from the Buddhist, from our perspective, even if there's a clear recognition of awareness in an ongoing way, there can be initially, and there will be initially, the assumption that it's always there. Because every time you look for it, once you've recognized awareness really clearly, every time you look, am I aware? You are. If you weren't before, you will be as soon as you look. And so the assumption and the feedback seems to be awareness is always there. Whether I'm aware of it or not, awareness is always there. And that's a wrong assumption. Because even when you can, or when there is ongoing, steady wisdom, recognizing awareness, you will see that it's flexing. But that's a very subtle experience. So when you see that awareness is flexing, then you see, this me, is no more solid than this experience, this momentary experience of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought, feeling, knowing. They're all impermanent. And there's nothing other than that, except the unconditioned.
But it's so simple, I mean, you get right down to that. It's so simple and beautiful. Like, if we can go right to the heart of what you just said, so much suffering lessens and drops away. Because it's like you're right. When you said before, you'll look for that emotion, where is it? Look for that mind, where is it? Like, and I was thinking to myself, yeah, look for ourself, where is it?
You can't see the mind that way, you know. The Tibetan, and I don't know the Tibetan tradition too well, but I do know that when they often say, look at the mind, look for the mind, turn and look for the mind. What'd you see? I didn't see anything. There, confirmation. Oh, well, it's hard, you know. Then they say, don't forget that, you know. So that's one way of pointing to it. It's only all we're ever doing is pointing to these understandings. But it's like the Zen master, you know, pointing to the moon and saying, look, 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 look. And neophytes see the finger. Yeah, 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 what? You know, and they don't see the moon. So we're pointing to awareness. What we see is me. We see the objects of awareness. We see me being aware. We don't see, oh, the awareness that's not personal, so to speak, but it's also not permanent.
Would you also say it's objectless?
No. No object, no awareness.
Yeah. It's so interesting to see that.
But wisdom can be an object. Oh, okay. Back to knee pain. Let's not get too far in there, out there. Yeah. Any other? Yeah.
This is an elementary question, but it kind of confused me. I read it somewhere. The belief is that we do not create our thoughts. Is that right?
The belief is we do not create our thoughts.
Like where thoughts arise and from sort of this,
Oh, the question. I mean, this is a well-known, famous question. Where do our thoughts come from? Right? Where do our thoughts come from? Where do our thoughts come from? Do you want the answer? Okay, are you ready for this answer? They come from the person behind you. Or I should say, that's how we should treat them. They're just somebody else's thoughts appearing on my screen. You know, and if you really understood, they're just thoughts that appear on the screen. You didn't intend to have them. You don't even want them. They're sometimes disgusting thoughts. They're sometimes thoughts that are self-damaging in the sense of, you know, beating yourself up. And it's like, okay, so if we could treat them as, well, just the impersonal thoughts that arise, then we wouldn't be bothered by them. But we can't. We really think, I'm thinking, they're my thoughts. They do appear on this screen, that's true, but where did they come from? Their own causes and conditions. I know that sounds kind of like, that's a cop-out. What causes and conditions? But nevertheless, or as Sayadaw Utejaniya, he says, you know, the mind is not yours, but you're responsible for it. Meaning, what appears in the mind is conditioned by, you know, prior experiences, the nature of the environment around you, and other, you know, historical and belief systems, assumptions that you have. That's what kind of out of that soup, out of that conditioning soup with all those flavors, thoughts are constantly streaming into awareness, right? Constantly. And once they arise, once a thought arises in your mind, you have to do something with it. You either indulge in it as, oh yeah, that's true, that's me, that's how I am, that's how it is, or you see it as, oh, this is just a thought, this is just a random thought, it doesn't have anything to do with me. So, but we're responsible for them, meaning once the thought arises, you've got to do something with it or it will torment you. It will definitely torment you. A thought of desire, if you don't see it as just a thought of desire, with awareness and understanding, then you will try to fulfill and pursue and try to fulfill that desire. Or if a judgment comes up and, you know, you just see someone. I know. You see the news. You open your phone, you open your computer, what it is, you see the news, you know, blah, 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 and you go, you know, whatever your particular reaction is to the news these days. And where did that reaction come from? It came from something completely outside of, conditioned by something completely outside of you. But if there's no awareness, then your mind, you lose your mind to the news. You lose your mind. Meaning the mind is jerking you around. I mean, the news is jerking your mind around. The mind is not yours. Same in a conversation. You know, when you have a conversation, as you listen, as you're all listening to me talk with him and we're having a conversation, it's kind of like the conversation is out here somewhere in the room, right? And we're kind of all kind of focusing on this conversation, following the thread, seeing what's being said, and we often lose our mind in the conversation, forgetting to take notice of what's actually going on in your mind. What's your narrative? What's your commentary? What's your kind of assumptions about what's being said? What's your beliefs? What are you rehearsing to say before you even, you know? So while this is going on, you want to be watching your own mind, as Utejaniya suggests. Don't give more than 50% of your mind to another person or to a conversation or anything outside yourself. Keep at least 50% right here, watching your own mind, so you don't lose your mind. And if you can't keep your own mind in the flux of, you know, dynamic, you know, social discourse and things like that, if you can't with 50%, then keep 70% watching your mind. You know, what's going on here? You won't miss a thing out there. Nothing important. Don't worry. You know, but mostly our conditioning is when you're talking to someone, you should give them 100% of your attention. That's like losing your mind. Losing awareness of your own mind. That's and then you're vulnerable to being hijacked. right? Somebody says something, you get angry. Boom, you're angry. They stole your mind. You lost your mind. You're out of your mind. That's what happens. I know that's kind of dramatic language. I like to use that. Don't lose your mind. You've lost your mind to some careless comment that somebody made. Or carelessly watching the news, reading the news, and not keeping a guard on your mind. If your mind gets angry, if your mind gets impatient, why? Because you're not watching it. You're not paying attention to it. You're just kind of lost in the mind, lost in the news. Dangerous. Yeah.
Is that the horror?
That's the horror. The thing is, we don't even recognize it as horror. You know, we think, you read the news, you get upset, that's normal, that's natural. You know, if you're not getting upset with the news, you're really deluded. But if you are getting upset with the news, you're also deluded. Oh. That's the horror. And it's worse than that, you know. I mean, the news is not the worst thing that's happening. You know? But the wonder is, here's the wonder is, all it takes is to be aware of it. As soon as you're aware that's what's going on, not out there, but what's going on in here, you're not caught in it. You're not entangled in it. You see it, you're aware of it, you feel it, you know it. It's not you. It's not yours. It's not who you are. You don't get identified with it. You don't resist it. You don't piss and moan. You don't complain. You don't blame anybody. You know what's going on. You know that it's unskillful. You know that it's hurtful. You know people are suffering. You know that you'd be suffering if you didn't recognize your own mind. But you can be free. You can be free. I could say the mind doesn't need to suffer if there's awareness and understanding. Right? That's amazing. I mean, and we got that, you know, for some of you who've been practicing for, you know, a year or two or 10, a decade or two or three, why is it we keep coming back to practice the Dharma? It's always painful. It's always upsetting. It's, you know, it's always, you know, it's always a struggle of some sort. It's like, it's not like you just sit down and like, you know, you got stuff going on. You got, you know, these torments that visit the mind. You know, and the torments that visit the mind cause suffering. As the Buddha said, you know, the mind by nature is radiant and pure. It is because of visitors to the mind that we suffer. And these visitors to the mind are attachment, aversion, and delusion in one form or another. And when we don't see them, then we suffer. When we do see them, same world out there going on, we're just not caught in it. We don't suffer. Sounds so simple. But the reason we keep coming back to do this, to keep looking again and again and again, is because we get a taste of freedom. We get a little taste. As soon as you can disentangle a little bit and you step back just a little bit, you get it. It's like, don't need to suffer. But you can't do that constantly. You can't do it all the time, so you get caught. So we come back again, practice some more, disentangle a little bit more, a little more freedom, a little more, a little less suffering, a little more freedom, a little more non-reactivity, a little more balance, a little more equanimity. And we can't control the mind, like, you know, the mind is not yours, you can't control it, you're responsible for it. We can't control the mind, but we can train the mind. And training the mind is to train it to be aware. Train it to understand things in the way that we stop suffering with what we see, with what's happening. And it can be done. That's why, you know, some of you have been practicing for decades. You know, that's why we keep coming back. It's not because it's always lovely, beautiful, paint, you know, bliss and joy. That comes occasionally too, but that's not the goal. The goal is to stop suffering, right? Anything else? I know there is. What? Yeah.
So the first part was when, you know, once I started sort of looking at awareness, looking at the knowing mind.
Yeah.
Was this kind of like really light awareness?
Light awareness.
So there's objects, like the objects kind of faded into the background.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of hanging out there watching the knowing mind.
Yeah.
But it was very light.
Yeah,
and
it did.
I started to get aversive to that. Like it, it felt almost dissociative or something.
What, you started getting averse to the lightness of knowing?
Yeah, like it felt like I was missing out on the experience of really suffering.
You know what? You are right. We are so used to suffering, we often will choose suffering over freedom. We get stuck on our views and opinions, and we will fight tooth and nail to defend our own personal delusion. You're right. Same, I know. You're right. That's a good way to put it. You know, it's like, I don't know if I can tolerate not suffering.
Good. I went into that, and it almost immediately became this absorption. You know, like it just kind of got lost and like became this very, you know. Like,
were you thinking about the
blissful and,
were you just thinking about awareness, or were you actually?
I directed my awareness. Well, it was kind of like what was talked about. It was almost like I directed the awareness into awareness, and it turned into this kind of feedback.
Oh yeah.
It turned into this very blissful experience.
Yeah.
And then I realized I was absorbed. So I thought, okay, I'm going to pull out of that and kind of bring the objects back in. And then the rest of the set was kind of trying to balance that.
Well, that's kind of what you did when you tried to make awareness the object of awareness. Is you kind of got object oriented about it, got absorbed in it. Mm-hmm. Absorption like that is blissful, joyful, ecstatic, subtle, can be exciting. Yeah. Don't make awareness the object. Recognize awareness, but don't be careful not to try to make it the object, to look at awareness like you do knee pain, thoughts, feelings, stuff like that. That's a little bit, you're right, it's kind of like involuting or something like that. But, you know, I like to think of when we practice awareness, it's an experiment. We're just experimenting with awareness because, you know, we try this, we try that, we look at it this way, we look at it that way. You know, sometimes it's, oh, this works, this doesn't work, this is skillful, this is not skillful, this leads to bliss, this leads to understanding, this leads to suffering. You know, it's all experimenting. And as long as you're willing to learn from your experiment, you don't make mistakes. You can get into a lot of pain, you can get a lot of dukkha, but if you learn from that experience, then it's a stepping stone to wisdom. So experimenting and making all the mistakes you want to make is good. It'll get you to wisdom. Because once you make a mistake over and over again, then you stop doing it. You know, this is how we learn. And some of us are really slow. We have to learn, you know, we have to suffer that way. Dozens, hundreds of times before we realize, every time, why do I do this to myself? I just get caught in this same old, you know, judgment, the same old bad story about myself, the same old habit of mine. And then at some point, we get it. We just go, we understand. It's causes and conditions. And once we see those causes and conditions, we can see it coming. We can see, I'm headed into the ditch. I see. Wait a minute. Back to the center, back to the middle way here. But it takes a lot of clarity of seeing, oh, these are the causes and conditions that lead to ending up in the ditch. You know, and then you start to step back and you see the causes and conditions before you get into the ditch. And then you say, whoa, I'm not going there. That's wisdom. That's the development of wisdom. But you have to end up in the ditch quite a few times before you understand that's how I got there. Interesting talking about the Dharma, I think, huh? You know, it's kind of like exciting, interesting, tantalizing. It's like, I always find it when I get in, not just when I talk, when I also listen, but, you know, just I'm trying to understand the Dharma, and talking about the Dharma is really enlivening, the mind gets really alive with, you know, sometimes, and for some of you it might be graduate level stuff, but that's okay. You know, if you never looked at a map of the world, you wouldn't go anywhere. You wouldn't know that there were other places long before you could ever go there and visit and know what they're about. So what you're hearing today is more details of the map of the mind. That's all. More details of the map of the mind, some of which are familiar to you, some of which are not. That's okay. If you keep practicing awareness, you will discover the terrain of the mind. You will actually walk on and taste for yourself the terrain of the mind. And it's not just because you know the map. It's because you've actually taken the journey of awakening and you now understand the mind. So what we're talking about here is the map of the mind. How to understand the mind, and how to, even if you're not there yet, but when you, if you keep practicing, if you keep wandering, if you keep experimenting with awareness, you will discover this terrain that we've talked about today. You will discover it, no doubt about it. You know, I can't tell you how to get there any more clearly than I'm telling you, but the goal is not to get there. The goal is to wander on, keep going. You know, because as you keep practicing awareness, then you fill in your, you know, the empty spots on your map with understanding. And that it's understanding that frees the mind. You know, we can get some temporary relief from suffering by, you know, antidotes. You know, when you're feeling aversion, practice loving kindness. It works. You know, and you get temporary relief, symptomatic relief. And development of loving kindness is a great thing to do. And, you know, there's a reason that you get caught in aversion. Right? And it's not just because you don't have loving kindness. There's wrong views, wrong assumptions about yourself that allows you to get caught in aversion. So while loving kindness is a great soothing practice for all forms of aversion, wisdom is necessary to uproot the seeds of confusion, delusion that allows aversion to arise in the first place. Right? So we have to see into the causes and conditions for aversion in order to be free of the tendency to aversion. But the experience of aversion can be soothed with loving kindness. But the seeds of aversion cannot be uprooted by loving kindness. They can only be uprooted by understanding, wisdom, insight. So as Sayadaw Tejaniya says, It's not you who removes these torments from the mind, aversion, attachment, delusion. It's not you who removes these torments from the mind. Wisdom does that job. But we can practice loving kindness and soothe aversion. We can practice forgiveness and soothe a lot of blaming. We can practice faith and soothe a lot of doubt. We can practice other forms of practice to soothe rampant desire, lusting and desire. But the seeds of them have to be seen with insight to uproot those tendencies towards resorting to aversion as a dysfunctional strategy for dealing with challenges in life. You know, and we all have these dysfunctional strategies. We blame, we complain, we self-pity, we get, you know, want more, desire, we have aversion, we get impatient. You know, we get depressed, you know, at times, and we get identified with it. And these are all just dysfunctional strategies for dealing with adult facts of life we don't want to accept. They're just dysfunctional. But they're deeply conditioned habits of the mind that we've come into this life with, and we've augmented with repeated indulgence in them. And Dharma practice is saying, well, wait a minute, I've been down this path of aversion. I've been down this path of impatience. I've been down this path of endless desires and craving. And where does it get me? More. Okay. There's got to be another way. Practicing awareness, understanding. So, yeah. So the question is, am I using the word wisdom interchangeably with insight? Not exclusively. Let me just say, you know, even when you hear the information that I'm sharing today, or when you read Utejaniya's books, or you hear other talks, or you read other Dharma books, you're getting some wisdom. You're getting some knowledge that you didn't have before. You're getting clear pointing to the way things are, even if you don't yet believe it. But at least you're getting that kind of information. That kind of knowledge that can be wisdom, for, you know, when people speak it or when you read it, it can be wisdom, but it's knowledge to you. That's what's called Sutta Maya Panya. It's wisdom from sutra or from hearing. It's the wisdom from hearing or reading. But that's not sufficient to uproot the assumptions of wrong beliefs in your mind. We have to also take that, what you've read, what you've heard, and you think about it, and you think, does that make sense? Is that right? And how does it work? And, you know, the mind churns with that kind of knowledge. You read a Dharma book, and you churn about what you're thinking, and, yeah, wow, I didn't think of it that way. Yeah, okay. And so you kind of use your mind to further develop knowledge about what you're thinking about. That's called Chintamaya Panya. Wisdom born of the mind, mental activity. But even those two, what you've heard and what you've thought about, is not sufficient for uprooting the seeds of delusion from your heart. You need what is called Bhavanamaya Panya, wisdom born of the development of the mind. And the development of the mind, in this case, Bhavana, means tranquility or collectedness of mind, samadhi, and wisdom, insight. So that's where the insight wisdom is located, in Bhavanamaya Panya. But you need all three. You need to hear the you need to hear the truth, you need to think about the truth, and you need to practice to reveal the truth. Those three together will result in liberation. Authentic wisdom from your own empirical experience. Not because you've heard it, not because you've read it, not because you've thought about it, but because you've seen it. You've realized it in your own. And that can only happen with samadhi, you know, calming the mind down, and insight, understanding the nature of experience. Yeah.
I thought I could just let the question go, but for me.
Ah, yeah. Thought awareness was enduring, right. Like ever present.
Yeah, so you're saying it's not.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh my gosh. You
know, oh, you're God or oh, you're Buddha? You said, oh my God. I'm.
Oh, gosh.
Gosh. Oh, I don't know gosh. I know Buddha and God. So, oh my gosh. Okay.
So I'm curious about that. But then you said, so I'm, you know, wondering, is that then just a construct of phenomena? But then you said, you know, what's left is.
Oh, well, that's the big secret, isn't it? Nibbana. Nibbana is the unconditioned.
So awareness is a function of conditioned.
Yeah. Awareness is conditioned. That's right. Thoughts are conditioned. That's right. The mind is that activity of the mind is conditioned. No, thoughts aren't awareness. No, thoughts are thoughts are the activity of mind. Awareness is an activity of mind. Love and kindness is an activity of mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now let me just say though that there are other traditions of Dharma, Buddhist Dharma teachings, that seem to imply, maybe even will claim, awareness is enduring. Yeah, that the nature of mind is enduring, and it is the unconditioned. I have to say, there are some traditions, some Buddhist traditions believe that. In this version of Theravada, the Burmese version of Theravada that I practice, no. So, you know, there's astute scholars of other fields that will vociferously disagree with me. Okay, so I'm not You know, you maybe you've heard that. That's okay. You know, how are you going to know? Yeah, you got this authority saying one thing, and you got some other authority saying another. That's why you have to develop the mind. You know, you've heard it, you've heard this, you've heard that, you've thought about this, you've thought about that. Now you have to actually bhavanamaya. You have to actually practice calming your own mind, samadhi, and developing insight to see for yourself. And only then will you know. And you'll never know for sure until you taste it yourself. Right? Come on. You can. Otherwise, it just is a belief that you just have a belief. You assume this person's right. And you believe that this one's right or this one's wrong. Until you know for yourself. You don't know. There's. I'm not saying that it is about this, but there's definitely use of the same word to mean different things within traditions and among teachers.
Yeah.
We all use the words awareness, knowing, mindfulness, you know, stuff like that. We use these, and different teachers will mean different things, and different traditions use those words differently. So it's good to know, and. So that when you hear people saying, using words in a way that you think you know what they're talking about, you always want to ask, what experience are you talking about? Because if they're talking about an experience, if they're using the word mindfulness for an experience or the word awareness for an experience, and they can tell you the experience, not using the flag words, not using those code words, and you recognize, I have that experience, I recognize that, that's my experience. Then you know what word they're using for that experience. That doesn't make it any more right than another person who says, yeah, but when I use that word, this is the experience I mean, which is different. You know, so that's, you just have to know, you know, you have to inquire, what experience are they talking about? And then you'll know for yourself whether you have that experience. Yeah. Okay, it's 3:10. Soon it'll be 3:11.